Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. It's today we talk about the management of chronic lymphocytic leukemia with Dr. Nicole LaManna, who is with the New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center in New York City. We also have several other investigators who took a survey of their usual treatment practices. And as we go through this program, we'll show you the results of that survey. But I think maybe it might be changed. We're going to have to repeat this before we do another one after the ASH meeting, because as it turns out, by great luck, the abstracts for ASH came out this morning, and there's some pretty interesting stuff in there. One thing in particular that we're going to get to, I'll just mention, probably relevant to that, that we will be talking about the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. So check out package inserts for rapidly changing things happening in oncology. Today, we're really going to make rounds with Dr. LaManna. We have five general medical oncologists in community-based practice, and we have eight cases from them that we'll be briefly talking about and really using those as a lever to get into some of the key data sets. Here are some of the cases that we're going to be talking about. We're going to just jump right in with a 67-year-old man. This is a patient of Dr. Bottinger, and you'll hear about this case as well as her questions.
This gentleman is 67 years old. He was interesting in the sense that he had COVID-19 three times before he came to medical attention to see me in August of 22. And he was referred for lymphocyte predominant leukocytosis. I was in the middle of my diagnostic evaluation, but before I could talk to him about the results, he basically had an MI. And so he sort of tabled the CLL diagnosis to have a six-vessel CABG about a month after I saw him. But ultimately, his flow did show CLL and then develops worsening cervical adenopathy, difficulty swallowing, and a change in phonation. His voice had actually changed a little bit. So he has another CT scan in May of this year, which shows a marked progression of adenopathy, which you can see on this scan in the neck, although the image here is of the abdomen and pelvis. And he was also noted to have an enlarged spleen as well. So the time had come to discuss what we should offer him in the frontline setting. And so I would like to know your current shared decision-making approach when it comes to talking to your patients about BTK inhibitor therapy versus frontline obinutuzumab and venetoclax. And my second question is, what is your current practice when deciding on which BTK inhibitor to use?
What's happened since you got the calibrutinib?
He looks great. Actually, he's only been on it for, you know, a little less than 4 months. And I mean, honestly, our visits are very boring. His lymph nodes completely resolved and his voice went back to being normal and his blood counts look a lot better.
So I'm sure you've heard this kind of story many times. I am curious how the recent MI and CABG might potentially affect a decision like this. Curious that he had COVID three times. I saw you did a lot of work during the pandemic on COVID and CLL. Curious what your thoughts are about that and how you would have looked at this before today, or maybe before ASH, or maybe before there's approval of what we're going to talk about. But let's just talk about how you would have looked at it previously.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously the caveat here we talk, of course, about is the coronary artery disease and the recent six-vessel CABG, and is he on, you know, an antiplatelet agent, anticoagulation, you know, what is he on? And so if he's on an antiplatelet agent because he had a six-vessel CABG, you know, you do have to, if you're going to talk about a BTK inhibitor, we would certainly approach him about using a second generation, given that, you know, they have less cardiac issues. You still have to tell them that these all can have increased bleeding and bruising. So if he is on, you know, an antiplatelet agent, that you have to still counsel them about the increased risk. Alternatively, and it just depends on, and I don't know how beaten up he was, you could have offered him, let's say, venetoclax obinutuzumab as well, if you were nervous about using a BTK inhibitor in this scenario. And I think the best thing to do is, you know, you also talk to the cardiologist and you really just want to find out how brittle he is, you know, that if he were to develop atrial fibrillation or have an issue, you know, how bad is his cardiac status? You know, I would probably want to make sure his echo is okay. Things like that, his ejection fraction, even though coronary artery disease is different than, you know, a regular arrhythmia issue, you know, you still want to kind of have a sense of how he is in case he does develop a complication, even if it's a second generation BTK inhibitor. And I think it's fair to broach that, of course, when you have that full discussion with the patient and see which, you know, which side they lean on. Then OB is a little bit more tricky, of course, because you also have to go through, you know, the ramp up and the maintenance and a little bit of, you know, that requires more monitoring. So the first 2 to 3 months of that combination is more labor intensive, but it is a time limited therapy too. So I think it's fair to, from a purely CLL standpoint, he's trisomy 12. I don't know if he's mutated or unmutated. Oh, he's mutated. So he could have, you know, from a CLL prognostic marker, he could get either regimen, you know, based on his disease factors. There isn't one I, you know, would prefer over another. Then it's really talking about the toxicity issues.
Choice of BTK?
I would do a second generation. Again, the, you know, either a Cala or Zano, I think, are fine. If you're worried, let's say, he has poorly controlled or difficult to control hypertension, maybe you lead a little bit to a Cala. Otherwise, I think Zano is fine. The cardiac issues with both are very small. Both of the head-to-head studies really show a decrease of, you know, HFib, but also cardiac events in general, and thus discontinuations due to cardiac events. And that includes zanubrutinib too. So I actually have no problem with either drug in this scenario.
So again, this patient had COVID, you know, diagnosed actually in 2022 initially, had it 3 times. Any thoughts, you reflecting back on your work and others of COVID during the pandemic and now?
Yeah, obviously, thankfully, very different from 2020 to 2021, 22. It was really, you know, for CLL and COVID was one of the deadliest things that I have encountered since doing this. And I've been doing this for 20 years now. The highest mortality was in cancer was in CLL patients. So it was really grim in the early years. Now it is very different. Now it really is much like when I see the flu or any viral complications in CLL patients, including COVID, it really is more akin to what we dealt with previously, that patients can get COVID or flu, may get sick. The most important things that really tend to happen are what we call post-viral complications, where they get run down due to whatever virus they get. And then I'm worried that they get a superimposed bacterial pneumonia. That's what we dealt with before COVID in 2020. That's what we're kind of dealing with now. So now the last year or so, you know, when patients get sick, they're not running to the hospital and getting admitted. We'll always get one or two every year that will come in with one of these post-viral complications, but that certainly is much more acceptable in this era of COVID compared to 2020, but not uncommon in our CLL patients to get COVID often and variability on severity, but much, much better compared to 2021 and 2020, you know, so I'll take it.
Yeah. And actually, you know, in this abstract or this phase 3 trial we're about to talk about, look, a lot of these deaths were from COVID. It looks like half of them, the deaths that occur. Anyhow, here's what I got all excited about. Well, we initially talked about last time we did this program with Matt Davids, and we were talking the press releases that I was trying to squeeze out of him details, but he wouldn't talk. So I think his partner, colleague Jennifer Brown's probably going to present this. But here it is this morning, and not embargoed. You know, it's interesting what they choose to put in the plenary session, because actually there's some kind of cool things, but I don't think it affects anywhere near as many patients as this abstract is. So the plenary got, I thought it was interesting, ketogenic diet enhances CAR T anti-tumor function. That's kind of cool. And efficacy and safety of oral BTK inhibitor rilzabrutinib in ITP is a couple of the interesting plenaries. But to me, this is the one that's going to affect a lot of people, and we're very looking forward to it. Let's talk a little bit about the design of this time-limited trial, looking at Acala and plus or minus Abeno versus chemo, FCR, BR.
Yeah, so this, I mean, obviously, this is a very exciting trial because in the U.S., we're all looking forward to seeing sort of these oral-oral combinations with acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib with the newer second-generation BTK inhibitors. Now, this did, as Neil suggested, this also, you know, did enroll because it's being presented now, obviously during COVID. So you can imagine that that was an implication. But it was to, you know, younger, fitter patients. They were not allowed to have 17p deleted because they were randomized to either Acalaven or Acalaven OB or investigator choice of chemoimmunotherapy. And so remember, because we don't think chemoimmunotherapy is a suitable choice for most patients, but certainly not for patients with deletion 17p or p53, you could not have that going on to the study. So that was the three-arm randomization. As you can see, it's a very large study, over 800 patients, so almost 300 in each arm. The median follow-up now is 41 months, so that's really pretty good. And you can see here that there was, again, maybe not surprising from some of the other randomized data that we have, the AV and AVO arms were superior compared to the chemoimmunotherapy arms with either FCR or BR. So there's no doubt that the median PFS has not been reached in the targeted therapy arms versus 48 months in the FCR BR arm. So really good. And even the AV demonstrated a little bit of an overall survival benefit already compared to chemoimmunotherapy. So there's no doubt that this met its endpoint with the superiority of targeted therapy over chemoimmunotherapy. And again, for many of us, the question is, we hope that something, because this is a randomized study, might lead to the first oral approval here in the U.S. Of an oral, a BTK-BCL2 combination. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. And, you know, it's going to make these choices like this first case, you know, a lot more interesting. Right. And, you know, I guess another thing is, I mean, it didn't, you know, randomize against, for example, Ven-Obin, but when you look at the hazard rates here and sort of indirectly compare it, does it sort of line up to what you would expect? I don't know if they're going to present patient-reported outcomes, but I would guess, you know, if you're getting a month or two of Acala rather than Obin, that those patients are going to be a lot happier and their doctors. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, this is definitely, if we get an oral approval here with Acala and Ven, I think this will definitely eat into the Ven-OB, pie, so to speak, that, you know, patients who are going to want a time-limited approach are going to say, hey, if this data looks just as good or maybe perhaps even better with longer follow-up, then I don't need to get something that's intravenous and have the hassle of sitting in the chair for hours, monitoring for tumor lysis, so on and so forth. And so I think that there's no doubt that I think that this will diminish the use of Ven-OB for sure, and possibly even BTK monotherapy, you know, chronic continuous therapy for folks who also want to take an oral drug but get off of it. So I think that there will be, I think this will be a game changer for a lot of patients here in the United States.
And certainly, you know, anytime this happens where an abstract comes out, we haven't seen any presentation. We need to see the presentation. We need to hear people talking about it. We just wanted to give you a little preview about what to expect. And I think we sort of dealt a little bit with some of the things that people might be saying. Also was curious, you know, at the last EHA meeting, they presented Zen and Venetoclax. And this was with people with DEL17P, TP53. Anything you want to say about that? And also, they now have a phase 3 trial looking at Zan combined with sonrotoclax, another BCL2 inhibitor. Any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's nice about this first, let's talk about the Sequoia Arm D. I think what's very nice about this Arm D is it's probably going to be the largest, it is right now, the largest study that has a large cohort of patients with 17P or TP53. And so that's really important because, you know, we always have this going, you know, we always have this discussion among CLL experts about, you know, can you offer a time-limited approach to somebody who has high-risk features? And most of us still prefer chronic continuous BTK inhibitor-based therapy. However, if the oral-oral combination looks good and is better than, you know, when we look at the data from venetoclax-obinutuzumab from CLL14, the PFS for patients with deletion 17P or P53 drops off. And so that's why most of us still favor chronic continuous therapy. But if this, you know, this large cohort of patients, you know, with Zanu and Ven look like the PFS is pretty good in a high risk patient population, then many of us might be, you know, might be more willing to give a time limited approach. So that's Sequoia Arm D, large arm of high risk patients. Now, what they have also is a sonrotoclax is a next generation, very potent BCL2 inhibitor. And so they started working with this and have combined it with their drugs and it obviously zanubrutinib. And so there is a combination of obviously the oral. And this trial also, you know, they have a trial that randomizes this to Venobi. And so so this is obviously something that we're all eagerly watching as well, as whether or not this is going to be similar to Acala and Zanu. Is this a better BCL2 inhibitor than venetoclax? I think that, you know, we don't know. That remains to be seen. Is it more potent or not? Will it mitigate TLS? Although one would argue if you're going to combine it with a BTK inhibitor, it won't matter because you'll downgrade their tumor lysis by, you know, front loading them with a BTK regardless. So I think we're all excited to see more data from the Zanu sonrotoclax.
So another question I'm curious about is, and, you know, we've been pleased, you know, when you use anti-CD20, for example, obinutuzumab prior to venetoclax, it helps debulk the patient, lowers the risk of TLS. How effective are BTK inhibitors in debulking in that, you know, from the same purpose?
Oh, absolutely. So I think that any of these oral combinations, you're going to front load the BTK inhibitor, and that will make it really easy for debulking, right? So, you know, because the lymph nodes decrease quite dramatically, very quickly. And then you could do that either in a 2 month, you know, different protocols have done it differently, either a 1 month, 2 month, or 3 month lead up. And then you could start the BCL2 inhibitor. And that makes it very easy then to do this all as an outpatient because most patients, the majority of patients are downgraded if they have high risk disease. And so it makes it much easier to do an oral combination with front loading the BTK. So it'll be much easier than, let's say, you know, even Venobi for sure.
So again, it's going to be interesting to go back to the faculty and ask them what they think after ASH. A lot of times we say to people, put aside reimbursement and FDA approvals, just what would you really like to give? And actually, we saw people talking about giving BTK and Ven, like, for example, for unmutated disease. A lot of people who did the research, they were saying like 2 years ago they wanted to do this. But now I think maybe it's going to be a lot easier in terms of accessing. So also we get into the issue we kind of alluded before, the sort of Coke-Pepsi thing of Zanu and Acala. We were just kind of curious how people thought sort of off the cuff, you know, putting aside evidence-based, just generally speaking, for what they prefer. And you can see some people prefer Acala, some prefer Zanu, and others like you say kind of a coin flip. But also we kind of pull it down a little bit more and say how you see, again, globally, efficacy and tolerability. You do see, at least Matt bringing up the issue of Zanu maybe being more efficacious, but also in terms of tolerability, it's interesting that some people prefer Acala or think that's a little easier, others Zanu, and you say depends on the profile. What do you mean?
Well, you know, I mean, efficacy, why I think Matt brought it up just because Zanu has the only data compared, you know, two BTKs that really did show a difference between ibrutinib and Zanu. Now, you know, we can go back and forth about there'll never be a head-to-head with Zanu and Acala, so just forget that, nor should there be to waste patients and money and time on that kind of a study. Toxicity profiles are a little bit different. You know, obviously we counsel patients if they're going to go on Acala that they might have they might have more headaches in the beginning, and that's really more unique to Acala than the other BTKs. Zanu, there's definitely a little bit more myelosuppression that I observe with Zanu. So you can have more neutropenia, a little bit more anemia and thrombocytopenia. And so I think you just need to keep an eye on that as well. The bleeding issues to me seem pretty equal across the board. I really don't see a difference. When we talk about hypertension, right? So some of the studies, the head-to-head data with ibrutinib and Acala obviously showed less hypertension with Acala. With ibrutinib and Zanu showed about the same degree of hypertension in that study. And so if you have, if really somebody who's poorly controlled, you might prefer Acala in that sense, versus Zanu. But there's also a difference in drug dosing, right? So, you know, Xanu you can give once a day rather than twice a day. And it has more dosing, so you could, you know, also reduce the dosing more easily if you want to, because you're concerned about a toxicity. Nacala is really a twice a day drug. So you just have to keep that in mind too. So some people may have a preference based on once a day or twice a day dosing. And there's only so many, you really can't, you can only either dose reduce to once a day with Nacala. And the question about that then with PK and stuff is a little different, because it really is, the PK is really a twice a day dosing. So there are things to think about that way. Whether that meaningfully contributes to long-term outcomes, I'm not sure we're going to get that kind of, you know, we're going to be, get that kind of data in the future. But, you know, they're just, you know, little subtle differences between the two. Overall, they're both really great drugs. So we're being really picky when you hear me say about all these little differences.
Just going on to another case, this is from Dr. Erica Rupard, 74-year-old woman, IGVH unmutated DEL13Q. He has a very interesting clinical question for you. Here's Dr. Rupard.
I'm curious for your faculty members, Neil. Do you ever treat patients who are Rye stage zero, no fevers, chills, night sweats, weight loss, no cytopenias, but have fatigue? Because this patient, who is, in spite of her 74 years old, is a bus driver for one of the local school districts and really enjoys that job, but she drives the kids to school in the morning. She says she goes home now and takes a nap and then drives them home in the afternoon. And that didn't used to be the case. Also curious, of course, what your regimen of choice is for a 74-year-old with a new diagnosis. This is somebody who's not very elderly, and also, of course, not very young. Do you prefer an oral therapy like a BTK inhibitor, or do you prefer the venetoclax obinutuzumab in terms of responses, tolerance, and so forth? So if I treated her, it would be to try to eliminate the fatigue. It is bothering her. It's affecting what she does during the day, so that might be an indication. I'll probably lean towards giving her a trial at treatment and seeing if, you know, after a couple of months of a BTKI, if she's feeling better. And if she is, then it may be worth it for her.
Any thoughts?
Yeah. So on par, I'm going to say that generally speaking, we really don't try, you know, we try not to treat people just on the basis of fatigue alone. Although obviously this presents a really interesting case in the sense that it does occur. So the question is how, he said she was in early stage, really didn't have any other indications for treatment except fatigue. So this is the kind of, you know, when I have these cases, and they don't happen very often, but when I do, I'm always thinking about, okay, so is the fatigue due to the disease? And if it is, am I committing her? So I actually try to avoid long-term therapy on this person, because I don't want to commit her to long-term therapy if she doesn't have a real indication for treatment, cytopenias or bulky nodes. So I'm thinking short-term, time-limited treatment usually for those. And also it serves as a trial, because if her fatigue doesn't get better really with treatment and it's time-limited, you get them off of treatment. You don't commit them to a chronic continuous BTK inhibitor. The other thing I've done in the past, and again, this goes back to an older error since I'm old, is believe it or not, these are the kind of patients, if they had no other indication, I actually would start with a monoclonal antibody. So let's say you were doing a time-limited approach. And back in the day, this was Rituxan, if you were worried if she's frail and you didn't want to commit her because you're not sure her fatigue is really due to the CLL. So you could do Rituxan, you could do Obina. But the point is if her fatigue really does get better, then you go, okay, then I'm going to add the oral agent and I'm going to do a time-limited therapy and be done with it. Now you're asking, Neil, well, now if we get approval for an oral, you could do the same thing in that fashion as well. So I guess the answer I'm trying to say here is I wouldn't commit her to chronic continuous therapy to put somebody through that because of the potential, you know, long-term toxicities that people have being on chronic continuous therapies, particularly if she may not need it and it's just treating fatigue. My experience with those individuals is if it's really due to the disease, they actually get better very quickly and you don't have to commit them to long-term therapy. So a time-limited approach would be something I would favor in a patient that you're not so sure that you really, you know, she has a real indication for treatment, but want to help her. And so that's one way to do that. That's what I would do.
Did you say you were old?
I've been doing
CLL a long time. I don't think so. So
20 years of CLL, though.
Oh, yeah, 20 years. So We got a question, actually a quick case from the chat room from Priya Rudolph, who works with us a lot. She says she has a patient with a small retinal bleed on a calla, but has well-controlled CLL, also on clopidogrel for coronary artery disease. What would you do?
Yeah, so, you know, there are some patients that I think, so one is you know, there's a couple things to think about. So one is speaking to the specialist and is this a significant retinal bleed that we need to discontinue therapy? Not, I don't think that happens. You don't necessarily have to do that for all patients. Two is also how long have they been on therapy? And if you decided to, if they've been on it a long time and had a very good response and she had another recurrent or it's a bleed that's not, resolving or reabsorbing when you speak to the optometrist, you know, then the question is, do you need to take them off or recurrent bleeds? I probably would. I haven't taken everybody off. There are some of my patients that I think still had better, but you also have to factor in that the patient's on an antiplatelet agent. So I think there's a couple, I would just dig a little deeper. If they've been on long-term therapy, there's a consideration for a break or changing. If they were a patient who had high-risk disease, you may decide you may not want to do that. If they have a 17P or P53, or if they have recurrent bleed, you might want to switch their therapy to VEN. So I think that you don't have to stop everybody's BTK for a bleed, depending upon how significant the bleed was. And I think you need to talk to the eye doctor, get a sense of whether or not they're concerned.
So yeah, the Priya says the ophthalmologist advised to stay on it. So she left.
So I think it's fine. Yep.
So, speaking of high risk, we also asked the faculty what they're thinking now. Again, after ASH, I'm not sure what people are going to be thinking. You might want to speculate on that, but pre-amplify del-17P, T53 or not. So without it, I guess people use their usual approach and you bring up all the options, which I think is also, I think everybody else would probably agree with that. But then when you get over to del-17P, T53, everybody said BTK. A little bit of preference one way or the other. Any thoughts on that one?
Yeah, so that's what we were talking about. I think that for most of us, if they don't have high-risk disease, you know, and they're fit, it just depends. I think people are seeing if this is a fit 70-year-old, do they want to do VEN-OB or not? You could still do time-limited. Keep in mind, though, even the patients who are unmutated with time-limited, their PFS does drop off, but they still can buy many years off of treatment. And so I don't think we, you know, will completely exclude the unmutateds from VEN-OB. The patients with high-risk disease, that's what we were talking about, is most of us favor continuing patients on a chronic BTK inhibitor. Now with this data with Amplify, Amplify didn't include 17P, but the Sequoia Arm D, the question was, is, you know, in patients with 17P or P53, can you give them an oral? How long is their PFS or their time to next treatment if they're on an oral? And could we offer that to patients with high risk disease? So I think that'll be a trial and an arm to watch. Otherwise, most of us still tend to give, you know, chronic oral continuous therapy for those patients with 17P or P53.
So this is a question we started asking in the old days. And I think when people thought about time limited, they immediately thought about, you know, obinutuzumab and obinutuzumab toxicity, looking for TLS. It's going to take a while to think about time limited BTK and venetoclax, a pretty different story. But anyhow, in the pre-amplify or pre-combination days, the question comes up, what fraction of patients would rather receive time-limited therapy? And maybe we kind of flip the numbers here a little bit.
Messed but that up.
I think it was just a question. I think a bunch of people flipped it one the other way.
You messed that up. In
any event, I think in general, there's been this feeling that younger people prefer, more likely prefer time-limited therapy. Older people are getting 18 medications, although I just doubt that you are. That might change, but I am curious, at least up to now, do you think that older people really would prefer continuous therapy BTK?
No, I think the oral combination, if we, you know, given how that is easy to do, easier to do, I think that if broached in that fashion, many older patients probably would be like, oh yeah, you can tell me I was going to start this drug. It's a BTK inhibitor, similar to what you would do anyway. And then later on add another oral drug and then I can stop them all in a year or so. I think that many older patients would be okay doing that too. I think when they hear about Venobi and we tell them about all they need to do, they're just like, that sounds like way too much work, doc. And you're going to tell me I need to come to the hospital that often and maybe even be hospitalized. They're not into that. You know, our younger ones are more committed because they want to get off a drug and just move on with their lives. Maybe they have kids and this, that, and the other thing. And so some of them are more willing to commit to all that front loaded work. And so, although it turns them off too, but I do think an oral combination will probably change this for both younger and older, and more people will probably choose that versus chronic continuous. Although I do think there's still a few select patients who might be like, start me on a pill. I'm fine with that.
So speaking of older, we actually have putting together some cases for this Aon meeting today, and we had a 97-year-old woman who got immunotherapy and had a great response and doing phenomenal. So opening up the avenue even into the 90s. But here's a patient of Dr. Shams Buffalino, who's 85. Here's the case and her question.
85-year-old female. She was diagnosed with CLL by peripheral blood flow testing in 2020 when she was found to have an absolute lymphocytosis. She did well for the last couple of years until more recently when she developed progressive fatigue, a 10-pound weight loss, and also a rapid rise in her white count with a lymphocyte doubling time of less than 6 months and also a new onset thrombocytopenia with her platelet count right around 100. I elected to start her on acalabrutinib just recently. I guess my sort of topic of discussion here was sort of what people were doing in practice for elderly patients with CLL, and if brutin kinase inhibitors were chosen, what typically were people choosing or not choosing to do for prophylactic therapy for infections, specifically for viral or fungal infections or PJP?
I think we talked a little bit about the age thing, but I think this question about prophylaxis, you look in the package insert, it doesn't exactly tell you exactly what to do. What do you do?
Yeah, this is a great question. And, you know, back in the day of chemoimmunotherapy, we really mandated prophylaxis, PJP and zoster prophylaxis uniformly because of the toxicities of, you know, the purine analogs and the monoclonal antibodies. You know, now with the advent of the BTK inhibitors, and targeted therapies, we saw a decrease, although not nothing, but we did see a decrease in those types of infections. So I usually take sort of a history that it will help guide me. And I'm pretty conservative. So, if somebody has a history of shingles, I really do kind of, recommend that they should be on. I really offer those people more zoster prophylaxis, even if they get vaccinated, because we know that CLL patients, their vaccination status, their immunity to vaccines is poorer than those without. So I still, would try to encourage those guys to be on prophylaxis. I offer, in the early days of ibrutinib. Now remember, that was in the relapse. So there's a difference between frontline and relapse as well. So in the relapse setting, there were cases of pneumocystis and there were cases of HCV, so there was more infectious complications, rightfully so, in the relapse population because these patients have had multiple therapies over the course of their lifetime. So that's an area that you might want to recommend more continuously, prophylaxis. I'm still, I do offer and talk about the pros and cons, but I don't mandate in the frontline setting if they're starting a BTK. I think Venobi is a fair option if you're giving an antibody that you might want to do prophylaxis. I have no problems doing it in that setting. My colleagues differ. Most of my colleagues probably do not offer a lot of prophylaxis in the frontline setting with targeted therapies. I tend to be a little old school and tend to do that a little bit more willingly, both in the frontline, but certainly in the relapse setting.
So Dr. Warren Brenner has a younger patient, 62 years old, who initially got treated 2010 with FCR, relapsed 2015, now had TP53 mutant disease, NOTCH1, gets ibrutinib, now has disease progression. Here are his questions.
She's had a few infection issues, COVID twice. She's had some sinusitis issues. So she's also been getting IVIG therapy on a regular basis, which has certainly helped. So my question in a patient like this is, in a patient with high-risk genetics, do you ever combine BCL2 and BTK inhibitor therapy? And what is the role of venetoclax versus pirtobrutinib versus referral for a CAR-T in a patient such as this who's starting to slowly progress has high risk genetics and has good functional status, younger age, where any of those options I think would be considered reasonable options. And also, what is the role of next generation sequencing in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and does it ever impact on management decisions?
Any thoughts?
That's a lot. So, you know, there's no doubt this person is still young. And so the fact that they had chemoimmunotherapy and ibrutinib, and now they have a Notch and a TP53, you know that they're not going to, that eventually this person's going to need more than one alternative therapy option, you know, in general, because they had a BTK. And so, you know, you can, there's lots of different options. One is I tend to, yes, can you, I guess in the short term, normally I would do a ven-based combination for this person because they got ibrutinib and now have a TP53 and a Notch. I'm going to tell you that, you know, don't get mad. I even would favor even continuing ven as a chronic continuous therapy because of their TP53. However, it is still not going to be indefinite therapy. Can you add ven to your ibrutinib, or can you combine oral in this patient? You can. You can do that as well. Ultimately, can you? This patient will probably also likely need perto. Yes. There's data obviously for that, because eventually the patient's going to fail venetoclax as well, or a venetoclax-based combination, whether it's with a BTK or an anti-CD20. And the patient is young enough that I do think that, so given that this will be her third line of therapy, so let's say you do some ven-based combination, I would have her evaluated for CAR-T. So I don't think that even if you're not doing it at the moment, because she might still buy time, she still has ven and she still has perto, you know, she will need it because she's young. And so I think eventually that might be a real option for this person. And so I do think that they should be evaluated, not wait till the last minute, but be plugged in so people are aware.
So I want to see if our video people can keep up with me, because I was just thinking maybe I ought to show you this other comment or series of questions that he brought up about pirtobrutinib and Richter's transformation, and maybe we can just talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib in general. But he also brings up some other issues. So here's Dr. Brenner again with a bunch of other questions he had, also not only about pirtobrutinib and toxicity, but CAR-T and also the management of Richter's transformation.
We know that pirtobrutinib has recently been approved in patients who have failed a prior BTK inhibitor therapy as well as a BCL2 inhibitor therapy. My question for the clinical investigators is this the only setting where they consider pirtobrutinib? What about the patient who has received a BTK inhibitor but for whatever reason refuses to receive a BCL2 inhibitor such as venetoclax? Would you ever consider using pirtobrutinib? And are there any unique toxicities that we need to be aware of with this agent? And also, do clinicians and clinical investigators ever do mutation testing in the BTK receptor to help make management decisions? We know that there is a CAR-T therapy agent approved in CLL for patients who have failed a prior BTK inhibitor and BCL2 inhibitor. Where would they use CAR-T therapy, and would they use it after pirtobrutinib or before pirtobrutinib?
Anything you want to hear the faculty discuss about transform CLL?
Are there certain patients who are enriched to develop Richter's transformation, particularly genetic data, particularly NGS, such as patients with Notch 1 mutations? And in patients who do develop Richter's transformation, what is the best agent to manage them? Should we treat them with anthracycline-based chemotherapy and then transition to a transplant? What is the role of CAR-T as a consolidation therapy after we potentially cytoreduce them with chemotherapy?
Wow.
I didn't tell you that whenever we have Dr. Brenner on, it's like a cognitive test for the faculty of their memory. Let's see how many of those questions you can remember.
Let's see. So first of all, let's talk about perto first. There's no doubt that the trial that led to its approval, which was the Bruin study, all the patients had prior BTK, covalent BTK inhibitor, but not all of them progressed. So some of them, so his question about can you, if they were intolerant, Can they get a PERTO after an intolerance rather than a true progression? And the answer is yes. And those patients were also part of the study. So all of them had prior BTK, but not all of them. Most of them were due to progressive disease, but there was a small, I think it was about 20 or 25% that were just for intolerance reasons. And so, yes. And the overall response is very similar to both of them. So they can absolutely get it. There's no doubt. What we don't know, which is a more the next level that I think he was thinking about as well, is what is the proper sequencing? So we don't have enough data. Should you go from covalent to ven to non-covalent, which is the majority of the patients on this study, or can you go from covalent to non-covalent then to ven? And so I think we just don't have enough data yet on going from covalent to non-covalent and then to ven in terms of PFS or time to next treatment. And you'll slowly see there are already studies that are moving PERTO more frontline and earlier line. So just stay tuned to talk about mucking up the waters even more. Stay tuned for that. But we don't know. But can you? Absolutely, you can. Now let's go to the Richters. There is no doubt, and I think that Neil was flashing some of the survey stuff, and I probably answered thinking differently than my colleagues. I think that there's a couple of things when you think about Richter's. One is it frontline? So in a patient who's never had treated for CLL and develops Richter's, do I think following along the lines of a traditional DLBCL, R-CHOP, R-EPOC, plus or minus venetoclax, given the data that we have then with R-CHOP in CLL and Richter's, I think is fine because those patients are potentially curative. And, you know, eventually their CLL will come back, but most of those guys are curative. Most of our Richter's, though, are patients who have previously had treatment. So 90% really are patients with a prior therapy for their CLL who develop Richter's. And your question about who are those that are more at risk? It is that definitely the patients who are TP53, deletion 17P, Notch mutated patients, those are definitely higher risk for developing Richter's prognostically. But yes, those patients I say that we don't have a good regimen for, and we're always looking at what, you know, it's a definitely an unmet need. And so we're always thinking clinical trials. There is data from the Bruin study that dealt with Richter's with PERTO. Obviously, it's much less toxic than doing something like R-CHOP or R-EPOC. I think that depending ultimately in a multiply relapsed Richter's patient, the R-CHOP, R-EPOC, or any therapy is usually not good enough alone. So oftentimes we're using that therapy to bridge them to something for curative intent. So it is rare that I could give R-CHOP or R-EPOC in a multiply relapsed CLL patient with Richter's that is going to cure them. That's not going to happen. So then I'm thinking about bridging them. So you could do that, but if you think it's going to beat them up, I think PERTO is a fair drug to use. Given that data that we have from the Richter's trial, I think it's fair. It's a fair drug to use as a bridge to either CAR T or an allo. And again, part of that might depend on, you know, how fit the patient is, their availability, you know, even of an allo. A CAR T is obviously a little bit more reasonable in that sense because they could be a little bit more beaten up and still go to CAR T versus, let's say, an allo. So I think that you have to have that conversation with your BMT immuno folks who could do CAR T therapy. But I think that one of the limitations we have with chemo immunotherapy in our multiply relapsed CLL patients is that it beats them up even more and they get more infections and whatnot. And then, you know, you have to hold the therapy and then, you know, the disease comes back and so on and so forth. So it's a little tricky in CLL who develop Richter's in that sense. So I think PERTO is a nice bridge. But certainly, I think a clinical trial is the better option for any of these patients. Bispecifics, there are trials with bispecific monoclonal antibodies and Richter's with combinations. I think those will be really good also for Richter's. Our Richter's of today is not quite the same as our Richter's in the era of chemoimmunotherapy. They're a little less sick. And so there's no doubt that I think the survival has gotten a little better. And as that doctor noted, you know, now we have CAR T cell that's been approved for CLL, the liso-cel got approved in March of 2024. And so that's it's easier now to get our patients to CAR T than it was before when you had to get them on a trial. So Richter's is challenging and you have to take into consideration how beaten up your patient is when you're choosing which regimen you want to give them.
And you were telling me about a patient. Yeah, you were telling me about a patient you have in their 80s. I would say that's more along the old line, but maybe not even there, who's been on it for 3 years with transformed
disease. I do, from the Bruin study. Yeah, she was one of the folks on the Bruin study that had Richter's, and she's in her 80s. I couldn't take her to a car or an aloe. She's frail, but she's still alive on Pirto, which is great. And then hopefully, you know, maybe another drug will come along that's not so toxic that if she relapses, we could give her something else. So those are the kind of patients, you know, not everybody could go to CAR T or an aloe. So you have to think about how to handle them. Usually chemoimmunotherapy isn't enough for our Richter's patients.
It's always challenging to compare indirectly between trials for things, but I'm just kind of curious in terms of how this lady did. And you're not too, most docs in practice haven't used that much Pirto, but from your point of view, do you think it's less toxic than the second generation agent?
He asked about that. I forgot. Obviously, Pirto hasn't been around as long as the other drugs. So we have less follow-up, although now we have pretty good follow-up. I'd say about 4 years of data on Pirto. And so it really is a very easy drug to use. The bleeding and the bruising, I think, are pretty fairly consistent with all the BTKs, but there's very little in the way of hypertension or cardiac toxicities. It's once a day dosing. So it's also really, it's an easy drug. It's very clean. Again, we'll see if there are any mounting toxicities. We had presented that data and follow-up last year at ASCO, and there was no new toxicities. It's still very low cardiac adverse events and very low of the other toxicities, with the exception of, I think, the bruising and bleeding is very similar. But I think it's a very clean BTK inhibitor. And as I said, you're going to see the non-covalents move up earlier in lines of therapy. So stay tuned. In fact, my colleague Nitin Jain presented a frontline, you know, triplet therapy with pirtobrutinib, ben, and OB in treatment naive patients. And the data looks outstanding. So we'll have to see. They're going to obviously increase the enrollment of that trial to see from this pilot to see, you know, how it compares to other doublets and triplets in the frontline setting. But yes, it's pretty clean. And I think he asked about NGS testing. Yeah,
right.
We could talk about that in general. And that just has to do with, you know, in general, you know, for time limited approaches. Oh, when he asked about BTK mutations, for time limited approaches, you know, I think, you know, we're trying to figure out how to use MRD testing, of course. The different sensitivities of NGS testing haven't been standardized. Obviously, you have flow cytometry, you have NGS, you know, so 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6. Obviously, the deeper levels of sensitivity that you can attain, you know, if they're truly MRD negative, that does translate into a longer time off of therapy. And so for somebody who's on a time limited approach, this is where that testing might be important, or we're trying to figure out how to use this. Obviously, if somebody's on chronic therapy, there's no point in testing. You don't need to do that. But for time limited approaches, there are three, I like to point out that there have been several trials that have changed how long time limited is. You have, you know, 12 months in some studies, then you have 15, 16 months in other studies. And then you even have, if you think about the UK FLAIR trial, which looked at ibrutinib and ven, that was based on MRD guidance from peripheral blood and bone marrow, the amount of time patients were on therapy was dictated by when they achieved their first negative MRD. And so they could be on a minimum of 2 years, but they could be on therapy as max as 6 years. And so what they notice is the longer, of course, that people were on therapy, the deeper, the longer, you know, the better their responses were. But then the question is how much is time limited then? So if you're going to be on for a long period of time, does that defeat the purpose? So I think we don't have an answer yet. And what we're trying to figure out is there's some patients that if they're MRD positive, if you continue drug, some will become MRD negative. But if you continue drug, some of them won't. And then those are the patients you should be like, you wanted a time-limited approach, you're not going to become MRD negative, stop your therapy. Similarly, if we could figure out the patients who might, if we hang on and they stay on a little longer and they become MRD negative, ultimately that may impact their subsequent response duration and time to their next treatment. Those are the ones you might extend. And so that's what we're trying to learn and figure out so we can help everybody kind of use MRD in a fashion that makes sense and is translatable into clinical practice. And then you'll say, yes, this based on these features, I think this patient, we can give them a little bit longer therapy, or no, this person based on their, you know, they're not going to get any, you know, if we extend therapy, they're still going to have some MRD, give them a break. They wanted a time-limited approach. So I think we're still learning how to use MRD testing in clinical practice.
So speaking of MRD, we have a case related to that. But first, just to take a look at a couple of slides. I was just looking at I love this. Well, it's one of my favorite waterfall plots in all of oncology. But I didn't notice, you just pointed out that light blue are people with toxic effects or other reasons. That's interesting. And then we're not going to go into these. Just check out the slide set if you want to get into it. We were talking about toxicity with pirtobrutinib. You've written a lot about it. You were just talking about bleeding risk. Here's a paper that looks at that, getting into that. And we asked the faculty where they're using pirtobrutinib, typically right now in the third line setting in patients with CLL. And you addressed the issue of what we know indirectly comparing efficacy and tolerability. So we're going to get into another case, but first one other thing of related to, we were just talking about transform disease, and here's the paper from this year's Lancet looking at, again, pretty good waterfall plot for Richter's transformation. Anything else you want to say about that?
Yeah, again, so you could see these really nice responses. And as I said, it's just much less toxic than R-CHOP or R-EPOC. It doesn't mean that this is going to be by no means indefinite therapy for these individuals. I think the lady I have is probably an exception. But I think that, most of these, you're going to need to probably bridge them to alternative therapy, but it's much more tolerable than an anthracycline-based chemoimmunotherapy regimen.
So a 46-year-old patient, don't see that too much, has got CLL as a patient of Dr. Maz, who got BR and then second-line venetoclax rituximab. And she actually got an MRD assay and decided to continue therapy. And that's what her question is. We do these surveys with docs, and most of them stick with the trial. But occasionally you find even investigators who will keep venetoclax going for MRD positivity. So she did it, and here are her questions.
My question is really MRD testing for CLL patients. What setting, how does it guide treatment? I'm still struggling with. So venetoclax, if we use in first line setting, after finish 1 year treatment, do anyone advise to routinely incorporate MRD testing to help guide, should we stop or should we do longer? If we decide to do longer because patient's MRD positive, how frequent you test it? You try again in a year? How does that routine practice pattern should be in this case? What about second line? I have several patients. They used BTK inhibitor and then they go to venetoclax second line. What will you do in that case? How is MRD going to be incorporated?
Any other questions?
Yeah, I am curious, anybody will borrow the first line data, use obinutuzumab in the second line setting and replace rituximab because it definitely has more cell kill in that situation. But I don't know the insurance approval situation. And if we are allowed to use second line setting, what about the timing? You do it concurrently or you do it sequentially like the first line. But I haven't done it personally because I just assume it wouldn't be approved. So I haven't tried yet.
You feel like you're on rounds with the fellows and they're just all throwing you one thing here? All right. Another memory test. Go ahead.
It's a great question. I mean, there's no doubt. So first of all, her question is great. And we all struggle with this, right? So we're not, I think for most of us, if a patient is really choosing a time-limited approach, we want to get them off therapy because that's what they chose. But I mean, I think there's a couple of things. If they're MRD positive, and let's say you tell the patient, the patient's like, well, doc, if I took the drug a little longer, maybe I become MRD negative. Can we do that? Have I done that? I have. I usually will test repeat testing somewhere, 3 to 6 months. If somebody is really still persistently positive, I'm probably going to talk to them about trying to come off to give them a break because that's really what they wanted. Now, again, you might question if they're high risk, do you want to stop it at all? That's a different question. If they're TP53, we can go into that whole diatribe. But, then I probably would have put them on a BTK unless there was a reason I couldn't. Otherwise, we're trying to figure out, what to do. For most part, we're telling folks that they should probably discontinue therapy until we have more data and can concretely tell. If you look at this from retreatment studies, so there are a couple of studies that are looking at you know, what we hope is that most people, if they get Venobi, that they're going to buy at least 2 years off of therapy, if not more. If somebody falls short of that, we're not going to want to retreat them with the same combination. And in fact, right, Matt Davids has his trial, the Revenge trial, looking at re-challenging patients if they got Venobi in frontline and then relapse, repeating Venobi, but depending upon the timing of when they relapsed, continue it longer versus shorter, and patients are randomized again depending upon how much time they bought off of Venobi in the frontline setting. And so stay tuned. So we'll learn a little bit about that in a prospective fashion rather than retrospective. So I think that most of us, which she also asked about, can you use obinutuzumab in the relapse setting versus the frontline setting? And the answer, of course, is yes. And I don't think, I'm not in private practice, but I don't have pushback in an academic institution about that. Now, that might be different in private practice. From what I hear from many of my colleagues, you obviously would prior auth for that, but most patients, you can use obina in relapse. So you just have to see if that's okay. It may be particularly, maybe there might be some issues depending upon somebody's particular insurance, but most of us do feel that obina is obviously a little bit more potent of a monoclonal antibody than rituximab is. And so I think that, yes, I think the notion is you could probably use it in frontline or relapse if you want to do that. One could also argue, however, let me quote Susan O'Brien, is that if you use more rituximab, there was an old study, before obina became into favor, when she did, using escalated doses of rituximab or even more doses of rituximab that was done in a cooperative group study with fludarabine, you'll eventually catch up if you're using a lot more antibody over time. And so you could also use more ritux if you really wanted to. That's just throwing a monkey wrench based on historical data. But ultimately, yes, you could use obinutuzumab in the relapse setting, if you want to do that. We don't have a good answer for MRD testing for you yet. I do think some patients would benefit from a longer course, but not all. And some will stay persistently positive. And then are you going to commit them to staying on ven indefinitely? And so that probably wasn't what they wanted to sign up for in the first place. Otherwise, they would have chosen chronic continuous therapy. So I think it's okay to extend for a bit. I don't have the right answer about how long, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months to a year. But if somebody's persistently positive, they're probably not going to become negative if it's a year and they're still positive. So then you have to make a decision. Are you just going to continue them indefinitely on venetoclax, or should you just really just give them a break off therapy? And that's what I would probably do.
All right, let's close with a 30-second case from the chat room from Rosanna. Has a patient in the mid-70s with CLL, but a history of diffuse large B-cell, has an ejection fraction of 20%. I don't know if that's from the prior anthracyclines. But now I'm just going to make it more brief. It may have an indication to treat. What do you think about BTK in somebody with an ejection fraction of 20%? Or generally, how do you think that through?
So they have DLBCL now, or they had DLBCL?
No, they had it before. Had it before.
And now just have CLL.
Right.
Oh, okay.
I guess cured of diffuse B-cell, I would assume.
So the only question about that is, if they go into AFib with a BTK inhibitor, will they, how much reserve do they have? And so, right, so you might put them into heart failure. And so that would be my concern about somebody who's got a poor ejection fraction doing a BTK inhibitor. I would prefer probably doing ven on that patient for that reason, just because I'd be a little nervous. But I would also talk to the cardiologist, like how brittle, there are some patients who aren't really that brittle despite their EF being low. So I would want to know from the cardiologist, how brittle are they? Because I might want to avoid the class in general, even though second generations are much better and have much less AFib, it's still a risk. And so I might choose a ven-based approach, unless, let's say, the patient got ven and then they relapsed and you still needed the drug. Then, of course, I think you'd be like, okay, I'm going to do this, but we're going to have to, you have to be upfront about the fact that if they go into AFib, that there's a potential they can go into heart failure because their EF is so poor. So.
Feel better? Would you feel better with Pirto if you could?
Maybe. Although I don't really have a comparative analysis. As I said, the data looks really clean for Pirto. I'm not going to lie, but it's not like, it also looks really good for Zano and Acala with the AFib. I mean, it's really low. We're talking less than 5%. So I'd feel better for sure with a second generation or with Pirto if you were going to do a BTK at all in this patient. But I would definitely loop in cardiology about that. And you have to be upfront with the patient about that.
So, Nicole, I'm not going to lie by saying this is the fastest hour I've had in the last few months. My brain is like, whoa. But anyway, that's a good thing, particularly for CLL nowadays. We really needed it. Thank you so much, Nicole. Thanks to the audience for attending. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you.